This is the Management 291 podcast, Surviving Organizational Behavior, produced by governanceproject.org.
Welcome back, Anthony.
Well, thank you. Not that I missed any podcasts.
True.
As other people have.
That's true.
But no, nice to be back together again. And this week we're talking about power, organizational power, trust, influence in organizations. And it is, I think both of us know it's a very important subject, but maybe it's not so evident for everybody. What do we mean when we talk about power in organizations?
Yeah, we see power in organizations in different ways. We see it sometimes in a very formal way in terms of the roles that people have. You know, am I the CEO and who reports to me? In some companies, which are more hierarchical, we see a very complicated system of reporting, managers, and so on. In flatter organizations, it's maybe not so obvious, or it's not something you can pick up from looking at the organization chart.
But that's where influence comes into the picture, right? I mean, if you've got a flat organization, I mean, it's very obvious if you're using a hierarchical model where you got the delegated power from, well, as we talked about in chapter one, from the board of directors, who have responsibility for the performance of the company, they delegate powers to the executive, and the executive issue orders, set the objectives, check that everyone's doing what they're supposed to be doing, and make adjustments as they learn as they go along. But in a flat hierarchy, as you indicated, it's a little bit different because it gets to soft power as opposed to just straightforward legitimate power.
Right, but that doesn't mean that there certainly isn't power, and there certainly is, even if you're working in a completely flat organization or an organization where the co-CEOs share an office and have an open door policy and are ready to speak to any employee at any time. That doesn't mean there isn't a dynamic of power, nonetheless.
You mean they're not looking to the employee to come and help them, tell them what they need to be doing?
I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt. I'm sure they are, but they probably get distracted by many other things during the day.
No doubt, you are right. I mean, I was talking to the students today about the fact that they had the corporate visit last week to Banque Internationale de Luxembourg, and how, in fact, the executive that was speaking to them was emphasizing that he was a very type of listening kind of organization, that they very much wanted there to be open door policies and they wanted there to be a relative flat organization.
That's right. He also described how that wasn't always the case, and it's actually only been a few years that they've adopted a fully sort of open door policy. So even he accepted that the way they think about power has changed dramatically over the last few years.
Of course, it could also be a reaction to the incoming recruits to the organization. It's more and more millennials, as we know, and more coming in now. There's the next generation who are just sort of beginning to graduate from school. And they seem to be much more demanding in terms of having a continuous dialogue, to have a continuous interaction with their superiors as well as their peers.
And there's less of an acceptance that power should be consolidated with one person. I think that just isn't really on with this generation of workers. And, you know, I think to some extent looks a bit arbitrary or even unfair. Yeah. So there is a bit of a revolution or a devolution going on in terms of power within companies.
And in fact, it's going a little bit off script here, but you know, today in class we talked about change management, which was the subject of last week's podcast. And we talked about the pace of change, the way in which technology and challenges are coming up so fast and furious that in fact management style has to change with that, because the expert who's been promoted to be the boss today was the expert yesterday and is no longer necessarily the expert today, and is therefore having to interact in a totally different way with his or her subordinates, because they're the ones who are living the current digital revolution and who are actually best suited to finding solutions to the new problems and challenges that are being thrown up. So it's probably a total reset of the relationship of power of solution identification, if you like, that's actually also forcing through a different way of of exercising power and authority in an organization.
That's right. And whether you're in an organization or a relationship or any other context, nobody likes giving up power.
Correct. So the textbook sort of sources of powers, we've talked about one, which is called legitimate power, right? The delegated power. There are other ways to use power to influence people's behaviors, which would be the use of the power to give rewards and incentives, but also softer things like expertise, charisma, information power, which is a relatively new concept. How do these play out?
Well, I think different companies value this kind of power in different ways. In some companies, we'll really look to people with expertise and we'll value that and we'll give them a lot of power, and their expertise will assist them. In other cultures, in other corporate cultures, information might be withheld, or they might have an extremely transparent culture where everyone gets the same amount of information. And that obviously controls how power is distributed within the company. Information power is an example where, you know, things can get pretty ugly pretty quickly inside of an organization if not everyone has the same level of information.
Yeah, and that's where we get into politics, right, where people abuse, if you like, their monopoly on a certain amount of information, and they don't share, and they try and use it to advance themselves in the organization as opposed to sharing it to help everybody join together to achieve the objectives of the company. And I just introduced there the notion of abuse of power, which is something that we've heard quite a lot of in the last few years, particularly in the context of Me Too, which has been sort of a very clear one, but it manifests itself in many ways.
We have, and I would be interested to know whether there are more cases of abuse of power now than there were, say, 20, 30, 40 years ago. A quick scan of the news, it looks like there are abuses of power being exposed every day in large corporations. The reasons for the abuse of power are nothing more sophisticated than they would have been in the past. Very simple. People thinking that they can get away with things they know they shouldn't. Greed and getting ahead. It's not more complicated than that. Just because it's in a corporate environment, it's absolutely the same as in any other context, really.
Yeah, I mean, I recall in my younger days, I had no real sense of that there was a lot of abuse of power going on around me, but I was acutely aware of the fact some people had a lot of power and could basically decide A or B, and everybody would just act accordingly. And I think we've maybe moved both generationally away from a sense of loyalty to duty, which maybe is the baby boomer kind of approach to things, to being more concerned about outcome and impact on self, which is of the younger generations maybe.
That's right. I think people are definitely, they're questioning power. They're questioning large concentrations of power and wondering whether that's correct. And they're also questioning each individual exercise of power. So they're not just blindly following instructions. And so even if you have the power today, you need to be able to, I'll use the word persuade people that your use of power is appropriate. Because what we're seeing is there is zero tolerance for inappropriate uses of power. And this is, sadly, a relatively new phenomenon.
Yeah, and I mean, we see it in the sense that a lot of companies have set up whistleblowers programs where you are encouraged, if you are fearful of speaking up because you might think someone might abuse their power and retaliate against you for speaking up for something that you see as being wrong, we are encouraging people to pick up the hotline and talk to compliance or an outside agency who's going to handle it anonymously for you. And we also have a sense that social media has allowed people to shine a lot more transparency on these kind of abuses as well. I think there is a consistent and ongoing trend to keep on questioning the use of power.
That's right. And I'm sure it's really the tip of the iceberg. For all of the cases that are uncovered every week about abuse of power, there must be hundreds, if not thousands more, which go on undetected. But indeed, there is a sort of societal cultural shift around really questioning how power, where is power located and how is it used.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have to hope that the younger generations are going to be maybe a bit more responsible than some of the older generation that are on their way out. So you mentioned the word persuasion, Michael. And I suppose we've partly been answering that question, but if you have power, why do you need to persuade? Why can't you just instruct?
Well, I guess you can just instruct. I guess the question is, how successful would you like to be? So, I think there are circumstances and situations where just instructing is probably a very effective and efficient way to go. There are, though, instances where you're going to find that just telling people what they need to do is not going to get them moving. And so I'm really more of a path of least resistance kind of guy. You can push and push and push, and you can yell louder and louder, or you can try and get people rowing in the same direction as you. And so the way that you do that is you persuade them. So how do you persuade them? Well, you've got to make this meaningful for them. You've got to think about what are the drivers that, might get the person across the table from you moving in the same direction.
Yeah. Traditionally, what old school we've been doing is just to educate, just to give instructions, give information, and persuade people to act in accordance with the obvious interests of the organization and themselves. But that doesn't work so well anymore, maybe partly because, as we discussed, we're going away from the sort of baby boomer sense of duty kind of generations to the more outcomes-focused younger generations. So we need to actually not only have an educational process and information sharing, we also need to have an emotional attachment. And we need to, people will not change their behaviors, they will not engage with their instructions unless they feel excited about it. Obviously they will, but as you said, not to the extent that they're going to do it more than the bare minimum of what they have to do.
That's right, and we're in an information age right now. We're in an information age right now where the people who you are managing, they have access to all of the information. As a decision maker, you are no longer the sole source of information and of truth. If your people need information, they'll Google it and they'll have it. So, in fact, there's probably too much information out there. Mm-hmm. So what you've got to do is, how do I make this meaningful for the person across the table from me? They have the information. If they don't have the information, they'll get it. That doesn't really matter. How do you get them excited about it?
Mm-hmm. I think you're absolutely right. I think there is so much information available out there that it can be extremely confusing. And as we see every day in the news, the same news is reported in a left-wing newspaper and reported in a right-wing newspaper. And in one, the outcome of the conclusion of each story is completely disparate and confusingly different. So we can't rely just on information anymore, which I think is why we come back to this sense of the need to get employees engaged. As we said before, the use of power without engagement doesn't work quite so well. People are not motivated, people are not engaged, they won't be enthusiastic about it. And I think this is where we need to be very clear again on the story. Why do we exist? What is our objective? What is our vision? What is it that we're really good at? What is it that makes people excited to work with our company? What is it that we can do to improve the overall performance of all of us together as a team? And I think that's the kind of emotional tie-up that you need to try and create for people. And that's where just education, as you say, is not enough. People have to feel what is the right thing to do. They have to analyze the information that they receive and be able to draw their own conclusions. And you have to give them the framework to do that.
And I wouldn't want anyone to think that by using the word story, we're trying to manipulate anyone here. But what we are doing is we're bringing the relevant pieces of information to the person in front of us and basically helping them make that link, which is what needs to happen.
Yeah. So when we're talking about having an organization, trying to make people understand what is expected of them, trying to make people understand, for example, the need for change, which is what we discussed in class today, is it utopic to say that we want people to come together automatically and to seek out solutions to the changes they see around them? Or is it something that we still have to go back to giving specific incentives, if you implement this change, we'll give you a bonus or whatever it is?
Yeah, it's well, bonuses are always helpful, no question. They're definitely persuasive for me, but I don't think it's utopic at all, especially given the new level of engagement of employees in companies today. They're looking at the bigger picture. They're not tying themselves up to a company for 20 years just for a defined benefit pension. So they want to understand the decisions that they're involved in. I think even if they're not the ones taking the decisions, or if they're not the ones with the power, they want to understand that the power and the decisions are being executed in the right way.
Mm-hmm. Well, when we try and persuade people to implement some form of change in procedure or change in objectives, there'll always be pushback. So there won't be a natural rush to let's throw everything out the window and start again. So there'll always be this tradition of pushing, as it's called, to inform people, to go out and to call a town hall meeting, for example, or call a staff meeting to explain the changes you want to have happen and maybe to explain what the advantages will be. But I feel that we are in a period of change driven by digital revolution, where people who are going to be able to properly identify the change requirements are people who are normally, we would say, in the subordinate ranks, people who are in contact with the clients, people who are experiencing the technological difficulties at the front end of the business.
That's right.
And I think that the hierarchy, our usual, our executives, the bosses, as we used to call them, they have to start listening far more. So I think another reason for creating an environment where people feel passionately involved in the success of the project is that we need them to be so interested that they're actually coming and informing the hierarchy, hey, now we have a need for change, now we need to do something and act on it, which is sort of like creating a pull environment where people come together automatically to discuss things. Because we, as the old guard executives, and I say that only about myself because of my age, I guess, but we can no longer sit there and dictate to people, this is how you do it, because yesterday's way of doing things is no longer today's way of doing things.
And I just think back to an example, a sort of train wreck change management example that I experienced, which I think was probably a hybrid between sort of where we were 20 years ago and where we are now. You know, executives taking a decision to do a pretty important change, and so they hire some change management experts and bring them in, and the change management experts tell us all of the benefits of change and why it's important to constantly change. And then at the end of the session, they tell you, so we'll be informing you about the change next week, and now that you know all of the good reasons for change, of course, you'll be willing to go for the change when we tell you about it next week. I get where the exercise was trying to go. It was trying to have employees understand the potential benefits of change, but what was clearly missing in my example is, what are the benefits for me?
Mm-hmm.
What are the benefits for my customers? How do I make this relevant? Because, you know, human beings are extremely logical. You can explain to them that that change has to happen and that change is good, but they've got to understand why.
Yeah.
And they've got to understand what's in it for them.
And it's got to be, yeah, you're absolutely right. It's got to be referenced in the terms of who benefits and how do people benefit. And if it benefits our customers, for example, it'll also benefit us because we'll have happy customers,
exactly.
et cetera. Whereas normally it's like, well, we have to do this change because we need to reduce costs.
Right.
Right. It's not like we need to do this change because with lower costs, we'll be able to offer a cheaper product to our clients and make them happier. That's a silly example, but it's a little bit along those lines. But in discussing this pull and push, I think we've basically just talked a little bit through the Tim Baker influencing framework, which the students will study more in detail. The final point maybe is we put trust into this chapter alongside words like power and influence. Care to try and explain why?
Well, I think it's pretty easy to see, especially given the discussion we've had about how things have changed, how important trust is. And you know, you can go quite a long way affecting some pretty serious change on the basis of trust. Look at it the other way. If you don't have a sense of trust between employees and their leaders, how difficult is it going to be to implement change? You know, employees are sometimes asked to do really challenging things. Mm-hmm. And we're looking to them for a lot of courage, a lot of innovation, a lot of unknown. So without trust, this is going to be a pretty difficult assignment.
They have to engage. They have to trust that you have their best interests at heart as well. I mean, that you're at least, if you're not going to be there as a boss to optimize their interests because there are so many interests to be taken into account, they have to feel that they're going to be treated fairly.
There are different levels of trust, is what you're saying.
Exactly, yes.
And that's, I think that's a workplace reality. We all sort of coldly understand that, you know, I'll go this far for this person, but I probably wouldn't go that far. And in a sense, those relationships do work. People mm-hmm. understand what their level of trust can and should be and what they can expect out of that relationship.
Yeah. So, in fact, the nature of, in a low trust environment, you probably need a lot of use of legitimate, hierarchical, hard power.
Exactly.
I can fire you power. And in high trust environments, it can be much more to agree on consensus outcomes and ways forward.
But just, you know, I think a word of caution to those thinking of using hard power, you know, yes, I can fire you, but, you know, I think we also need to accept employees, you know, who are not happy with that kind of dynamic are quite happy to find the next opportunity, especially in a hot job market. Mm-hmm. So I think even those who are resorting to, you know, formality and legitimate power probably need to think about the trust element as well, because, you know, it's at risk of really eroding.
Yeah. Well, it's by the by, maybe, but I have met and talked to a number of what we call millennials who have simply said, I don't like working here, and they've quit their job. They've not been fired. They're not even waiting to be fired, right?
Exactly.
I mean, they've just said, I don't like the environment here. I don't like my boss. I feel badly treated. I don't feel this is a fair environment. I'm just going to take 6 months off and do something else, which to us baby boomers sounds very high risk, but it seems, I've heard it enough times now that I'm convinced that this is a social trend that is clearly manifesting itself. And I think nobody likes to lose people, especially not good people, and you will, as always, find it's the best people who leave first. The ones who are disinterested and are just there to earn their salary, they're the ones who stay.
That's right. And, you know, you can be bitter about millennials as much as you want to, but if you're the manager who's facing the millennial who's just resigned to take a six-month sabbatical at age 24 in Sri Lanka, you know, you can criticize that all you want, but the reality is the next day you have to go talk to HR about getting that role replaced,
exactly,
the interview process and all of the rest of it.
Yeah.
So it's not easy.
No. So I think it's what we call organizational justice, the sense that no matter what you do, you're going to be judged fairly relative to the performance of others, that you're not going to be disadvantaged because somebody is being favored ahead of you because maybe they're the top performer and they're being excused having to follow certain rules. Basically, the sense of equity within the organization, that I am being treated like anybody else on the same benchmark of performance, is very, very important for this generation. It was for our generation. My generation certainly was important as well. But I think it's become that much more transparent and that much more judgmental in many ways, and for the good.
I think that's right. I think there's a lot more access to information. You still see some areas where this one's tough, for example, bonuses. Notwithstanding all of this generational change, people still don't sit around the lunch table and disclose to each other what they got in terms of a bonus, what they received in terms of a performance rating. But there are sort of only a few places now where this kind of information is truly confidential. And there's a lot of information sharing going on between employees, which I don't know if it's positive or negative. It's hard to argue against the transparency, frankly.
Yeah, and I think it's both correct and important that those in a position to allocate reward and those who are in a position to treat people in different ways if they wanted to, that they really are very disciplined about how they go about their business and are able at all times to be able to explain why they have behaved, why they have rewarded, why they have punished.
Well, they need to be held to account.
All the time, yeah. All the time. Accountability is really becoming increasingly important at every level, and it's not necessarily present at all levels yet, but it certainly needs to be there. So I think at the end of the day, yet again, we end a podcast emphasizing the importance of maintaining a trust culture. It seems to be something which drives so many different aspects of behavior in organizations, Mike.
That's right. So if it's so simple, why is it so complicated?
Good question. Just ponder on that till next week.
All right. Take care.
See you then. Bye.
That was the Management 291 podcast with Michael Schweiger and Anthony Smith-Meyer. Music by Kevin McLeod of Incompetech.com. Thank you for listening.